At more than $1 trillion and counting, the federal deficit has set a new record this year. Many states don't have the luxury of running big deficits. They're required to balance their budgets, pretty hard to do in this recession. Plus, with more people out of work, the need for social services has placed further strains on those budgets. We're going to spend the next few minutes visiting several of these states. Michigan is one. The unemployment rate hit 15% this summer. A number of other states missed their budget deadlines this year. We'll begin with one of them, Arizona, which only has funding for part of this year. NPR's Ted Robbins reports.
Students at the University of Arizona are enjoying a warm, sunny afternoon between classes, and federal stimulus money has allowed many of those classes to keep going. But financially, that's about the only good news here. Because of the state budget deficit, the U of A has cut nearly 600 faculty and staff positions, it's eliminated some degree programs, and it's merged others. In many cases, even the research dollars have dried up.
The declines that we've seen are simply stunning. In 30 years, this never happened before.
Marshall Vest heads the Economic and Business Research Center at the University of Arizona. When he says the declines are stunning, he's also talking about revenue for the entire state. Arizona is heavily dependent on its idle home construction industry. Sales and income tax receipts are way down, so the legislature has been talking about selling state buildings and leasing them back, borrowing money, cutting whatever it can. But Vest isn't optimistic.
I mean, you could lay off every state employee and not even begin to balance the budget. You could defund the universities, for heaven's sakes, and not even begin to balance this budget.
In fact, unemployment insurance for laid-off workers is putting an even bigger strain on Arizona's budget, along with increased needs for Arizona's version of Medicaid, K-12 education, and prisons. Republican Governor Jan Brewer has vetoed portions of the state budget, including cuts to education.
We need more revenue to get this turned around.
Brewer wants the Republican-led legislature to put a temporary sales tax increase on the ballot. If it passed, that would raise about $1 billion a year, a third of the ongoing deficit.
It's the right thing to do, and I happen to trust the voters.
The legislature has so far refused to consider raising taxes. Legislative leaders say this is an opportunity to slash government spending. Right now, Arizona has enough of a budget to fund government until January. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
I'm Susan Phillips in Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania is now into its 11th week without a budget, and it's taking a toll on social service providers. At Avenue Childcare in South Philadelphia, 8-year-old Francesca Huff is playing with her baby brother.
Come on, open the window. Open the window. Huh? I want to play with blocks now.
But Francesca and about 50 other kids here may have no place to go if the state's budget impasse continues. That's because the majority of their parents rely on state subsidies, which Pennsylvania has not paid since July.
I'm angry because the governor is still getting his paycheck. He's still feeding his family. We're not feeding our families anymore.
Joanne Regalbuto owns the daycare center and says she has not been able to pay her workers for 2 months now.
Look, we're ghetto people. What do we have? We don't have bank accounts, savings accounts, you know, pension plans. We can't withdraw. We can't go to the bank and make a loan.
She says three workers have quit, and most of the others are behind on their rent and mortgages. Parents worry about losing child care if the center has to shut down. Jonathan Matos is a single parent who just recently found work. His 2-year-old son loves being here.
If I lose child care, I'll have to go back into a shelter. I mean, me and my son lived in a shelter for close to a year before I did get this job. So losing that would be a real bad thing.
State legislative leaders say they have come to a bipartisan agreement on the nearly $28 billion budget. But Democratic Governor Ed Rendell says the deal, which raises taxes on cigarettes and cuts his increases in education spending, is a phony budget. One that depends on overly optimistic revenue projections. He says he will veto the bill.
There is no indication that we will have an increase in revenue this year. In fact, there are counter indications.
It's widely expected that lawmakers will override the governor's veto later this week. But for now, Pennsylvania remains the only state without a budget. For NPR News, I'm Susan Phillips in Philadelphia.
This is Rick Pluta in Michigan, where, unlike Pennsylvania, the state officially has 15 more days to wrap up its budget. But an impasse in budget negotiations is already posing a hardship on cities, public universities, community colleges, and school districts. That's because they all have fiscal years that began in July, and they rely heavily on state funding. Governor Jennifer Granholm and the state legislature are struggling to erase an almost $3 billion deficit. That's caused uncertainty for thousands of college students and their families. One of the programs that could be cut is Michigan's universal $4,000 scholarship for every student who graduates from high school and completes 2 years of college or career training.
I mean, it's scary.
Michigan State University student Laura Dazzi says she's confused by the conflicting stories she's hearing out of the state capitol. She's paying for school by working and taking out student loans.
I need the money. Like, my parents both don't have, we don't have family money or anything. And I know both my parents, their hours keep getting cut more and more. And I have two other older sisters who they're still paying off their college stuff too.
Saving that scholarship is one of Democratic Governor Granholm's top priorities. But many Republicans argue it's a luxury the state can no longer afford. And Senate GOP leaders say they won't raise taxes. The situation bears a striking resemblance to a budget standoff in 2007 that culminated in a brief pre-dawn government shutdown on October 1st. Granholm wants to avoid a rerun of that drama. She says things are not quite so dire this time around because of federal stimulus money.
There is no need at all to shut down state government. This is a different scenario than existed in 2007. We have cash flow because of the stimulus dollars. So shutting down should not be an option.
But stimulus funds won't cover the entire shortfall. The governor's called for new taxes on things like bottled water and for reducing tax breaks for businesses and for working poor families to help make up the difference. That's similar to what's happening in other states struggling with politically unpalatable solutions to budget problems. For NPR News, I'm Rick Pluta in Lansing, Michigan.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Steve Inskeep is on assignment. I'm Renee Montaigne. Doctors, by a large majority, support adding a government-run health insurance program that would compete with private insurance. That's according to a new survey. What's been called the public option continues to be one of the most contentious issues in the healthcare debate, but the survey shows that doctors are already used to dealing with government-run insurance. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
In the survey, nearly three-quarters of doctors said they favor a public option. Co-author Dr. Salome Kehani is a researcher at Mount Sinai School of Medicine.
The results of the study demonstrated that the majority of physicians support a public option in the United States of America.
That included the 63% who say they'd like to see patients get a choice of public or private insurance, and another 10% who favor a public option only. They'd like to see a single-payer system. When the public in general is surveyed, support for a public option has run between 50 and 70%. Co-author Dr. Alex Fetterman, he's also at Mount Sinai, says it shouldn't be a surprise that doctors favor a public option in numbers even greater than Americans in general.
Probably the most important reason is grounded in physicians' experience with Medicare.
Doctors already have lots of experience with that government-run health insurance. The survey also asked the more than 2,100 doctors about how they compared Medicare with private insurance.
Physicians favored Medicare when it came to delivering care to patients. They thought Medicare was better when it came to autonomy and their decision making and their ability to get patients the care that they thought the patients needed.
There was plenty that doctors said they don't like about Medicare. They said private insurance was better in terms of reducing paperwork, how much they got paid, and how quickly. Dr. Varshi Brumund, a Texas nephrologist, has seen some of his kidney transplant patients deal with one of the biggest absurdities in Medicare. The government program will pay for a patient's expensive kidney transplant, but it won't keep paying for the drugs a patient needs to keep their body from rejecting the transplant.
After 3 years, they're out of luck because Medicare will stop paying for their medications.
27% of doctors in the survey said they support private insurance only. They don't trust government to get it right. But Brumund, despite his problems with Medicare, isn't one of them. He supports a public option.
If you have choices and options, you find the plan that best suits you. It provides healthy competition to lower costs and hopefully provide more efficient and better services.
Lots of the doctors in the survey said they sometimes run into problems with Medicare. But Kehani, who's spoken publicly in support of a public option, says doctors she spoke to for the survey often worry more about their uninsured patients.
So many of Americans are uninsured, and physicians have to take care of uninsured patients. A public option would sort of help guarantee that most people had coverage. And I think that's very important to physicians who wake up in the middle of the night, they go to the hospital, and they take care of patients and are not reimbursed. So having a guarantee of reimbursement of some sort, I think, is very appealing to most physicians.
The new survey was published online by the New England Journal of Medicine and funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a healthcare organization that favors health reform. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And we should note that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation also supports NPR. Thousands of new American troops are arriving in Afghanistan with the mission of training that country's army. Benjamin Tupper knows what awaits them. He's a captain in the Army National Guard. He was an embedded trainer with the Afghan National Army, known as the ANA, earlier this year. While there, he shared his experiences with commentaries taken from his blog. Captain Tucker brought Morning Edition vivid portraits of his comrades in arms, like his recklessly brave machine gunner Ski and Fayez, his gentle young translator who was later killed. Now Benjamin Tupper has collected those and other stories in a book, Welcome to Afghanistan, Send More Ammo. In it, Tupper has a rather endearing name for the army he helped train.
The Flip-Flop Army, it was a tongue-in-cheek reference to flip-flops. Afghan soldiers, it's a new army. It's a young army, and there's really no uniformity per se. It wouldn't be uncommon to have some Afghan soldiers jump out of a pickup truck in pursuit of Taliban wearing flip-flops or basketball sneakers, Speedo swim goggles, baseball caps, New York Yankee t-shirts, the gamut.
And yet none of this stopped them from being in fighting form.
Not at all. They come from a tradition of individual fighters. That is how you make your reputation, through individual acts of bravery and courage. And you can see from maybe pictures or newsreels of today's Afghan soldiers. They look more, as we like to say in the Army, high speed. They're starting to get uniforms that match, and they're wearing their proper equipment. And to this day, I think if you were to talk to embedded trainers who are on the ground today, they would probably still reflect that, hey, I got some great fighters in my Afghan unit, and these guys are braver than anybody I've ever seen, but they won't work as a team. They're going at it alone. They're just doing their own thing, and it really causes more problems than it solves.
Maybe you have a different moment, but there were any number of moments that were just sort of laugh out loud funny, or certainly chuckle funny. One of them was when you were in a firefight surrounded by Taliban, and
yep.
you truly were, at least a couple of times, that close. I mean, close, like a rocket that just, fortunately for you, something was wrong with it and it didn't hit you.
It blew up in front of me instead of in me, yeah.
And then when finally reinforcements arrive, after quite a long time, you run into this sort of grizzled, what was he, Special Forces guy?
Yep. I pull open the Humvee door expecting to see one of my teammates, and there's this guy. He's big, he's burly, had no idea who he was. And I go, "Who the hell are you?" He introduces himself. He outranks me, so instantly I'm like, "Whoops." And he goes, "What's the situation?" I go, my voice is breaking. I mean, I've had it. I am toasted. I'm like, "We've been surrounded for 2 hours." And he kind of looks back and he goes, "Surrounded? I love being surrounded." And instantly, the mood changed. I mean, I instantly felt like I had just been lifted up and removed from that whole problem, because there was someone here who, A, outranked me, and B, had been doing this a lot longer than I had.
And C, had obviously a sense of humor.
Yeah, and you know, for those who have been to war, they'll understand what I'm about to say. And a lot of people, when they see the book, you know, the subtitle includes the word tragicomic. And people go, "How can it be funny? How can it be funny?" Because some of the funniest things happen when your life is on the line and you do something stupid. And you go back that night and you sit around the base and you retell the stories, and you'll never laugh harder.
You tell a story that is ultimately disturbing, but it began when your unit stumbled onto a patch of emerald grass hidden in a dusty valley. You refer to it,
yep,
as the Garden of Eden.
That's what it looked like and it felt like and it smelled like, yeah.
Can you tell us about that? Because it says a lot about what tends to happen there.
I think that that story perhaps sums up the whole Afghan experience for me. You go into the fight thinking you know who is who and who's on what side and why they're fighting. And in this case, we were presented with the story from a group of Pashtun villagers that there were hundreds of Taliban occupying a secret base camp on a mountain just outside of their village. And the Garden of Eden that you refer to, I don't know why it was there. I don't know what geological freak accidents occurred to cause this small lake and everything to be lush green. But that was the Pashtuns' land, and that's where they fed and watered their animals. In reality, up on the mountain, there were no Taliban. It was a tribe of nomads called Kuchis. Well, one of the Kuchi animals had wandered into this Pashtun Garden of Eden, and all hell broke loose. They confiscated the animal. The Kuchis came to get it back. Gunfire. A Pashtun boy was shot and killed. It wasn't pretty. But the Pashtuns knew that if they told the Afghan army and police they were Taliban, we'd come and clear out the Kuchis. So the Pashtuns really were using us to settle their score. We had no idea that that was what really had transpired. We were just told, there's a lot of Taliban. You guys got to go get them. And we had arranged airstrikes. We had arranged a great plan to literally decimate everybody on that mountain. And literally within minutes, this pristine Toyota black Land Cruiser rolls up, and a tall, very handsome gentleman steps up, who turns out to introduce himself as a member of parliament, and that he's a member of the Kuchi constituency, and that the people on the mountain are not Taliban. Had this Kuchi parliament member arrived 10 minutes later, the airstrike would have gone off, and all these Kuchi civilians would have had been killed. And I would have been the guy who would have had to go to bed every night knowing that I was the guy who orchestrated airstrikes that killed a couple hundred civilians. So I'm very happy things played out the way they did.
What did writing a blog as all this was happening, what did writing this blog do for you?
I found it very therapeutic, and I didn't spare any details. I wasn't one of those guys who just called the wife every day and said, everything's fine. I had to be open and honest about what was going on and what it was doing to me and how difficult it was. You know, the army gave you pills for sleeping and pills for anxiety and depression. But to me, writing was what worked the most. It really just helped me get through it.
Ben, it was great talking to you and hearing your stories again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Benjamin Tupper is a captain in the New York Army National Guard. He's just out with a collection of essays, Welcome to Afghanistan, Send More Ammo. And if you go to npr.org, you can hear some of those commentaries. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of conservatives marched in Washington protesting the health care proposals before Congress and other initiatives of the Obama administration. Their complaints included taxes and the government's bailout of banks last winter. But some black Americans have sensed another element fueling the anger of the crowd, a sense of refusal to accept an African American in the White House. Joining us to discuss the controversy is NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, there has always been vocal opposition to any president, especially when he pushes a new and really different agenda. What would you say is different about the pushback that this particular president is facing?
I think there's a perception that being called a liar during a speech before the joint session of Congress is unprecedented, Renee. It fits with a pattern that lots of black Americans, and I might say it's also on Hispanic radio around the country, perceive as sort of a lack of basic acceptance of the stature that's to be accorded any president, a question of his legitimacy. And that pattern includes things like, was he really born in the United States? What's he going to say to our school children? Should he speak to school children? The suggestion that socialism is his real agenda. This undercurrent, I think, is sparking a great deal of anxiety about the way that he is treated as being distinct from any president before, and of course, he's the first black president.
And now, has this been around all year since President Obama was elected or inaugurated, or is there something really different about recent days?
Well, there was an undercurrent, but in recent days, the episode with Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina shouting out, "You lie," as Obama was speaking to the joint session, has really exacerbated that anxiety. And it's led to this notion that There is disrespect, even condescension, in the way that Obama is being treated as compared to any other president of the United States. And it's also then, I think, led to lots of discussion of whether or not there's a greater chance of Obama being physically attacked, assaulted. This was heightened, of course, by people who were bringing guns to some of the August and other Tea Party events, to express opposition to President Obama's policies.
Now, this view is the opposite in many ways of what conservatives and how they see it. You know, they've been saying all along that President Obama escapes a lot of criticism and scrutiny precisely because he's the first black president.
Exactly right, Renee. I mean, he's been portrayed as the media darling, treated as the so-called, quote, messiah by so many in the press, and therefore, in the opinion of many conservatives, not properly scrutinized, that many of his policies and actions have simply been accepted. Now the conservative argument is that they're being censured, that any criticism of President Obama is being treated as evidence of racism without any evidence of such. Congressman Wilson, though, is a Southerner. He's been out raising money, riding a wave of anti-Obama feeling. Yesterday, he was the first Republican speaker on the floor, and he didn't apologize, but instead hailed as patriots people who'd been attending August town hall meetings in opposition to what he called a government takeover.
Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Renee.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams. The U.S. Internal Revenue Service says time is running out. Americans who've evaded taxes by using offshore accounts have less than 10 days to turn themselves in without the risk of going to jail. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Wealthy Americans trying to evade taxes have often used offshore bank accounts, and bank secrecy laws have made it hard to find the tax cheats. But last month, as part of a court settlement, Swiss banking giant UBS agreed to turn over the names of about 4,500 Americans who the U.S. believes may be involved in tax fraud. They and others with unreported foreign accounts have a chance to come clean, but the deadline is September 23rd. They'll have to pay back taxes and penalties, but in general, they won't be prosecuted criminally and won't be subject to even stiffer penalties. Seattle University law professor Lily Kong says the government is taking a pragmatic approach, noting tax fraud is hard to prove.
These are wealthy, sophisticated taxpayers who will fight the IRS every step of the way. So as a practical matter, I think the IRS may be saying, well, let us just cut our losses here and try to collect what we can.
Seattle attorney Robert McCallum says dozens of people have contacted his firm for help in going to the IRS.
They're intimidated with the prospect of the IRS discovering what was previously a secret bank account.
Apparently, lots of people are intimidated. According to the government, in a single week of July, roughly 400 people turned themselves in. That's far more than in all of 2008. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.